Hi, this is your host, Gareth Rice, and you're listening to Canadiana Suite on UMFM 101.5 radio station. This is a radio program primarily dedicated to highlighting the works of the many talented Canadian jazz artists on the scene today. We've got John Gordon here to talk about his newest album, Strangers in Fiction, which releases this Friday. John is a renowned saxophonist with a wealth of performing experience, which includes being the winner of the prestigious Thelonious Monk Saxophone Competition back in 1996, and playing professionally with names such as Maria Schneider, Bill Woods, Ben Maunder, Hank Mobley, Bill Sharlup, Clark Terry, and many, many others. He currently teaches right here as a faculty member in the U of M Jazz Studies program. Before the interview, here's a recording of the saxophonist Bill Woods playing the jazz standard very early live at the Village Vanguard. Phil Woods was an incredibly important mentor to John and helped him develop his skills as a musician during his formative years. Following that, we'll be checking out two tracks, the standard Stardust and the Thelonious Monk tune Baya, from a great duo album from 2001 called Contrast, between John and the pianist Bill Sharlup, who is well established as one of the leading modern jazz pianists today and has played with John on several occasions.
Thank you.
Hi, we have John Gordon with us today, an accomplished saxophonist and educator from New York. How are you doing, John?
Good, thanks, Gareth. Good to be with you.
So we'll get right to it. You're releasing an album, Stranger Than Fiction. I was wondering, like, what's the idea behind the album? Like, what's the concept you have?
Yeah, the title track, Stranger Than Fiction, is something I wrote, I believe, in 2001. I've had a couple of these kinds of conversations lately, and it's allowed me to kind of think through some things. I had a couple things going on in my life at that time, and some things going on in the world at that time that would just made me feel like I really didn't expect this, you know. So I wrote that piece, tried to record it in 02, but I didn't get a take of it that I liked, so it wasn't released. And also Havens was written there at that time. And most of the rest of the music, except for Waking Dream, which was written way back in 92 at my friend Bill Mays' cabin in Pennsylvania, was written more recently, I'd say last 5 years or so. And basically with what we've been dealing with in the world the last couple of years, and I think even I would venture to say the last 5 years, and really, frankly, this century, I just think a lot of things have changed. And sometimes things have changed in ways that we might not have expected. And so, yeah, I just, truth and reality sometimes is a difficult thing to discern. And having shared facts is important. And we don't always have that. So it sometimes leaves us, in a bit of a challenging place.
Yeah, especially now you can relate it to like social media, for example, or like you could say like the news, or like how there's just a bunch of misinformation, or just how things are distorted through like a lens of reality. You could definitely link it to all these things.
Absolutely. The piece Waking Dream that I wrote back in 92 was inspired a little bit by the opening of a book that I've recently started rereading called Shadowland by a friend of mine named Peter Straub. Peter Straub is a brilliant writer. He co-wrote a number of books with Stephen King. I would say after Stephen King and maybe Dean Koontz, he's, you know, sort of in that top three or four in that, you know, authors in that genre. He wrote a book called Ghost Story that was made into a movie in the early 80s. He happens to be a big jazz fan, and I met him at a club. He was a Phil Woods fan. I said, man, I'm a huge fan of your books. He wrote liner notes for the first record I did in the States in 95. Anyway, this book, Shadowland, opens with a chapter entitled He Dreams Awake. And this piece, Waking Dream, you know, sometimes it's hard to tell what's real, what isn't. And that was kind of the inspiration for that. So a lot of the music is basically inspired by, that kind of search for some kind of shared reality, and determining ways of determining that.
Another unique thing about your album is that there's a lot of like faculty members and like people you've worked with in the past, like extensively, and like also alumni from the U of M. So I was
Yes.
wondering, did you like given that, did you arrange for specific people in your album since you're like so used to how they play, or did you modify any elements to suit their playing?
Not exactly. I wrote all the compositions. I did all of the arrangements except for Havens and Stranger Than Fiction, which were arranged by Alan Ferber. But I was thinking very much of, the core kind of, what would you say? The core ensemble that we were able to record together in an organic way was Jocelyn Gould on guitar, Will Bonis on piano, Julian Bradford on bass, and Fabio Rognelli on drums. And so Fabio and Will are current faculty. Jocelyn and Julian are former students, and she's done master classes. Julian's taught at the school. I also had Reginald Lewis, Anna Blackmore, and Tristan Martinson, who are recent graduates, that they were part of the project. And Derek Gardner, who is our jazz trumpet professor. But basically everyone other than the five of us recorded remotely. So the gist of the record is based around current former faculty and students. And then we had a few guests like Orrin Evans guested on a couple of things that he recorded remotely in Philadelphia. Alan Ferber played on all of the pieces, as did well, John Ellis played on maybe a little more than half of them on bass clarinet. And we also had Larry Roy played one guitar solo, who was our jazz guitar prof. He played one guitar solo on the piece. So yeah, it was based around the majority of the players are affiliated with our jazz program at the University of Manitoba.
And I guess when you were writing those compositions, were you influenced in any specific albums, especially since it's a no net? Because like there are a ton of like there are some albums you could draw from, like Birth of the Cool, for example, or Lee Konitz. So I was wondering if you were influenced by any specific things.
I don't know if I was influenced by those so much. I remember I wrote a piece, I think it was 2014 or 2015, that became Modality, and that was started off as an assignment when I was finishing my master's degree at Purchase. And it was a specific assignment to try to build something off of the kind of crunchy voicings that Oliver Nelson uses on the famous tune on Blues in the Abstract Truth. It's going to drive me crazy. Oh, do dee da, oh, dee da, dee. Anyway, we'll think of it. But so
Yes.
that it started off in that way. But I would say that in general, my writing has been influenced by a lot of people. In 1991, I started to work a good bit with Maria Schneider, and I think my compositional thinking was definitely influenced by a lot of things she was doing. I was always very influenced by some of the small group writing of Wynton Marsalis in the 80s. Records like
Oh, yeah,
Think
Black Coats from the
and
Underground.
Black Coats from the Underground. I'm a big Kurt Rosenwinkel, Mark Turner fan. What the music that those guys have done separately and together. And those are some contemporary people that come to mind whose music I really enjoy. Nothing specifically necessarily for Nonet, but I would say playing in Alan Ferber's Nonet. I think he first called me in 2006 or 7, and I was thinking about doing something for a larger ensemble size. And I said, "Man, would you mind if I just kind of, utilize most of your guys?" He said, "Sure," and I helped with the project. And so I didn't have I was not super computer literate at the time, and I was kind of just learning about some of that stuff and just starting to study like music writing programs. So he helped me. We basically discussed the arrangements and the arrangements were there, but it was more the instrumentation and orchestration that we basically talked through, and he just saved me some time by putting it into Finale. So.
Yeah, so you could say like everything, like the compositions and everything, it could be an amalgamation of like just meeting people and kind of feeding off their ideas and just like all those kind of things.
For sure. I mean, I happen to like this ensemble very much because it still feels like a small group, but it has some of the arranging possibilities of a larger ensemble. And I like that feeling, you know. I did the BMI Jazz Composers Workshop, I guess, in the early 90s, and Bob Brookmeyer was there some, which was amazing. I got to, you know him a little bit. And it was Jim McNeely and Manny Album that really ran the program at that time. And I was very green about writing for big band, but that was my first kind of halting attempts at trying to learn how to write for big band. But I realized that I also wasn't hearing big band at the time so much. And what was interesting about Manny and Jim, they're both incredible composers and arrangers and great educators as well, is they said, don't worry about trying to voice out everything in the brass. Just think in terms of lines, think in a linear concept. And they got me started with something I was already doing a little bit intuitively, which is basically dealing with pitch cells, where you just deal with, you know, pitch relationships out of like, let's say, a scale context, and moving it around in a very kind of free way and allowing the confluence of those lines to then create harmony. And that goes to something that we spoke about a little bit in my composition class that I was inspired by in college. It was a book by Ernst Toch, Toch, entitled Shaping Forces in Music. And it was his chapter on harmony, which was basically, he felt the 20th century classical harmony was a return to polyphony. And so rather than thinking of like an accompanying left hand at the piano, plunking away triads and some kind of clear tonal melody in your right hand, that whatever was happening through a confluence of melodies that were happening simultaneously, it was creating harmonic events. I like that kind of thinking because I think it's very free. Now, it's very difficult for us as jazz musicians because you can't hand somebody a lead sheet that looks like that, but you can say, here's a bass line, here's the melody line, here are suggested changes, but you know, there's just a lot of very open possibilities if you think that way. So.
Yeah, that kind of reminds me of like the way they used to do it back in like the olden times, I guess. Blanking on the name, but like where they had like figured bass, where they just had like certain like notes that you just have for like bass, and then they tell the improviser to like improvise certain bass notes, and then they'd like play around the melody, and then they kind of like you said, like create a harmonic event based on like a certain guideline.
Yeah, I think that term harmonic event actually may have originated during the time of the Renaissance, I believe.
Yeah.
But it was true that classical musicians, that improvisation was a big part of what they did. Particularly, you think about, you know, there's a certain space in certain cadenzas and recitatives where the musician can be expected to, you know, improvise. And I think about Branford Marsalis's version of the Concertino da Camera for alto saxophone, which is one of the most brilliant renditions of that ever, if not the greatest, where he actually does improvise a cadenza and quite extensively, you know, quite extended. And it's great, you know. Or you think about somebody like Chick Corea or Keith Jarrett that have played a lot of classical music and are brilliant instrumentalists and are, you know, kind of musicians without limitation, you know, which is kind of what we all would want to aspire to be.
Definitely. Oh yeah, I also want to talk to you about the album art. Like it was kind of like a really interesting like visual. Like there's like I'm guessing it's you. You're like standing up there, and there's like a mirror, and it's like you're like different clothes. So I was wondering what kind of thing you were thinking about that.
It's funny, it's not me. There's a friend of mine who's a saxophone player on Staten Island. His name is Russ Palladino. He's a very good musician. He also has done a lot of things in CD production. And we got to know each other about 5 years ago. We had some friends in common, and he had read a book that I had written about growing up on Staten Island and being a saxophonist. originally from that area, from Long Island, and married a girl from Staten Island and has lived his whole life there. It kind of resonated with him. And he said, when my friend said, oh, John's a friend, he said, oh, I'd love to get to know John. I love his book. So we got to be friends. And he said, man, anything you ever need with album art and work, like I can do that. I can get it. I can get you discounts and you know, getting CDs pressed and stuff. I said, great. So the last couple of projects I did, I reached out to him and he came up, he found two things. It was just basically, you know, it's art that's just, it's, what's the word you want to say? You don't really have to pay for it. It's, I think it's been, you know, it's been published in such a way that you can utilize it. So there were two possible album cover photos. One looked like somebody was floating on a cliff, kind of overlooking, I don't know, almost looked like England or Scotland or Wales or Ireland or something like that, kind of looking down at the sea. And really what it is, I just think it's just somebody jumped, and the timing of the view of it, it looks like this person is floating. And so that we thought that one was kind of cool. And then Russ also found this one. It was all his research, really, found this one. And it's not me. It's just a photo of somebody where the reflection shows the person's front, but the you're looking at the person from behind, but there's basically the top and bottom of the person is inverted, you know, where so it's just, again, what's real, you know, what is the reflection of what, you know, it's a little bit like that. And so I thought that was kind of, I thought that spoke to, what I was thinking about with, the CD in current times.
Cool. Yeah. I think it fits really well. Cause like you said, with the reflection, just like picking which one it works out.
Yeah.
You're talking about, like, you're also like a jazz author. So, and you've also written a book called Jazz Dialogues, where you've collected like interviews with like the mentors and the musicians you've played extensively over the years. So I'd like to ask you, what was that like, having all those experiences and just writing them down? Was it kind of like making an album?
Different, but fun. You know, I never thought it was going to be a book. Like, when I got involved with Artistshare, which is the end of 05, the start of 06, I met Brian Camilio through a common friend, and Maria Schneider had just been the first musician in any category in the world to win a Grammy for an album that was not released in stores, and that was through Artistshare. And Tower Records had just closed. And I was like, man, you know, this dream of like having CDs in a store is kind of evaporating. So let me see what the next step or chapter is going to be. And so I reached out to Brian and said, can we do something? And he said, sure. But with Artistshare, they like to do more than just your CDs. So he said, what other content would you want to do? And I said, well, I think I just really like to talk to my friends and my heroes and my mentors. And I'll just interview them, do audio interviews. I'll go to the Apple store where I'll buy a computer and learn how to do stuff with it, because they would actually train you at the time. And so I did an interview with Eddie Locke. I did an interview. I went to Puerto Rico, did a two alto thing at the San Juan Jazz Festival with Phil Woods, who's certainly one of my mentors and heroes. And both those guys are like fathers to me. I interviewed Mark Turner and Maria Schneider and Bill Charlap and Steve Wilson. You know, just friends and musicians that I admired. And it just, you know, over the first two or three years, I think I basically had interviewed maybe about a dozen people or so. And then I kind of put it maybe on the back burner a little bit, because I wasn't sure what I was going to do with it, if I was just going to continue to upload the content to my Artistshare website. I really wasn't that active on social media at that time. But Brian had said to me when I first met him, and I said, suggested this idea. He said, man, that's a great idea. You could turn that into a book someday. And I really hadn't planned to do that. So it was just the content to load on my Artistshare website to try to get people to go to my site. And then I started to think, when I was working on my master's degree, maybe I could turn this research into a doctoral thesis. And I looked very seriously at doing a doctoral program at several schools, but none of the schools, they were interested in having me come, but they were not interested in something that is that wide open of like, what's your experience? What is it? You know, and the kind of thesis of my book is, what does it mean to be a stylist? You know, that's the opening is Jay McShann sitting me down at Heathrow Airport when I'd been bumped off a flight and couldn't figure out how I was going to get home.
Yeah.
And we were sharing a bottle of Aquavit. And, you know, this is the guy that gave Charlie Parker his first gig. So that was kind of amazing. And I got to play with him. I was terrified that week. You know, I was 20 and I just kept saying, what in God's name am I doing here with all these incredible contributors? But they were very nice to me. And then at the end of the week, you know, that was Jay sat and talked to me and said, hey, man, you sound good. Now you got to figure out what it means to be a stylist, right? And so he was talking to me about it. I was like, wow, okay. And so that's, without saying this to different people, like Bill Easley or Scott Robinson or whoever, you know, what does it mean to be a stylist? That's kind of what I'm kind of searching for a little bit. What are the things that inspired you? How did you get into music? And how did you find your own thing? You know, and what are the things that are important to you? So that's just kind of the way it developed, but it's a combination mostly of the interviews, but also I think maybe about 18 or 20 little stories from the road.
Yeah, it seems like you've been around like a lot, and it's just like, it's kind of inspiring just seeing like different side of jazz musicians, since like you always hear the music and everything. So it's just really interesting just listening to like their stories and like how like it impacts like you and just in general. Yeah.
Yeah. And I, you know, I think, you know, musicians, creative people in general tend to be great storytellers and very funny. Like, yeah, you know, some of the things that happened are like, I mean, I just crack up, you know, or certain stories that we were told, like me and Ben Maunder playing somebody's wedding with me trying to play the flute in 1994 and us playing Here Comes the Bride for 25 minutes. And like, it was just because the bride didn't show up and we were just, you know, I was getting oxygen deprived. I was like, please, oh my God, where is this lady? I'm not going to make another two choruses. I'm going to collapse here. And me and Ben just like, you know, just basically losing it. And also Ben Maunder being like a brilliant, genius, original. You know, just the idea that you're playing somebody's wedding ceremony with Ben Maunder, and we're up there doing what we were doing. It's funny, I got to play with Ben about a month ago for the first time in many years, and it was really great to see him in play. And he just joined the group The Bad Plus. I was really happy to see that. I mean, you know, that's also a big thing for me. Like, I really root for these musicians that I've been knowing, you know, in some cases 35 years or more since I was a teenager, and watching them grow and develop, and you just want to see their contributions be witnessed and be recognized.
Yeah, definitely. Do you have any interview tips for me as a burgeoning broadcaster?
Well, first of all, I would say you're off to a rollicking start, and I was so glad, you know, that you're doing this thing with radio, because I think like this is part of like different ways that people contribute, right? Like Kenny Washington, most people don't know he was on WBGO for, I don't know, 15 years. He's one of the greatest jazz DJs ever.
Yeah.
So we all, like, there's a lot of different ways you can make a contribution. And I think it's great you're doing what you're doing, Gareth. In terms of tips, I don't know if I have any tips other than, I know for me, my default, whether I'm teaching or doing interviews, is to find humor, because there's a lot of crazy in the world. And if we can laugh, we can figure out how to, you know, get to the next place and hopefully find some common ground.
Wise words. So I guess, do you have any future projects or future gigs coming up?
Yes, I am playing with a group of mine at the Rachel Brown Theater through an event as part of a series of concerts through Jazz Winnipeg on October 1st. And I'm looking forward to that. That will be my Winnipeg CD release gig. I had a CD release gig in New York on September 4th. And the CD is technically being released September 17th. And I have lots of projects, you know, like most musicians, we've got all kinds of dream projects. I'm hoping to do another book similar to what I did, Jazz Dialogues. I'll probably do a second version of that, second edition of that. I have two other large ensemble recording projects that I'd like to do in the next few years. One is a big band recording. The other is a project with strings, probably, you know, like a jazz quartet with strings kind of project where, and both of those, if all goes as planned, would similar to this current project, would feature a lot of folks in our jazz program.
Yeah, thanks so much for being on the show.
Thank you, Gareth.
Are there any, where can we find your album?
My album is available. If you go to artistshare.com, you'll find it that way. My website with them is a little bit old, but I'm on the homepage. If you just go to artistshare.com, or you could go to John Gordon Music and that would likely get you there as well. But I think the best way is just through artistshare.com. And that's really the main way. It's not on Amazon. It's, you know, when you do, the ArtistShare thing, it's not, you know, you don't go right to streaming services and things like that. It's a different kind of process, but it will be probably available for streaming and through Amazon and all like that in the next 6 to 12 months. But it will be exclusively through ArtistShare for the next, I'd say, the next several months, if not year.
Sounds good. Are there any tunes or any tracks from your album you'd like to play out with?
There is a tune called Dance. That might be a good one.
Dance?
Yeah.
Sounds good. Thanks again to John Gordon for being here on the show. This is Dance from his upcoming album, Stranger Than Fiction, which releases this Friday on ArtistShare. What you heard before the interview was Very Early from Phil Woods' Live at the Village Vanguard and Stardust and Baya from the duo album Contrasts. This has been Canadiana Suite on UMFM 101.5 radio station, and it's been a pleasure. Till next time. Thank you.